Hi, everybody. We want to thank our sponsor, Legion M. They are a wonderful company. We love working with them. You can go to their website, Legion M. They're also on all the various socials. They do really fun meetups. You can talk to directors. You can become a part of the projects they choose. They even have a program right now where you can help them find great movies to support. So go to their website to learn more. We also want to remind you that we have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And today we're going to have a special guest who, well, he's somebody that I love. He's my favorite entertainer and a brilliant guitarist.
Now, I'm just going to say, folks know my dad loves movies. But you've heard us talk a bit about his passion for music and very specifically jazz, big band and jazz. These are the things that make him happy. These are the things that bring him joy. He has forced this love onto me, which is why I decided that being a jazz voice major in college was a job one could have. Clearly, it's worked out really well. But for my dad, music, as it is for us as a family, is probably the thing, even more than movies sometimes, that just fills his heart all the way up. So the Pizzarelli family, wife, husband, father, is very dear to him, which is why having John Pizzarelli on today
is a treat.
Yes.
And the only excuse I needed, John, is that your new album, what do we call them now?
It's an album.
I have a physical CD here for those of you who want to embrace the last technology that worked. it's an album of songs from shows and movies.
Yes.
Hear the word movies? That's why this works. That's why this works.
As if you need an excuse.
And the title of the album is Stage and Screen. And it's my pleasure to introduce John Pizzarelli. Howdy.
I'm so happy to be here, and I'm glad I named this record appropriately. It's good to see you both.
Well, see, you've made the same horrible mistake that I have, which is you work with your dad. What were you thinking?
I know. The first couple of years, I was like, oh my God, what am I doing? And then I was very lucky. It was one of those things where then you start to go, there were times, you know, when I'd just say, listen, could you, you know, but most of the time, the learning experience of that kind of daily sitting with someone who plays all the right chords was a very good thing.
Your father was Bucky Pizzarelli, a much admired and much loved figure on the New York music scene, who made a living playing anonymously on record dates. Years and years and years before anybody in the general public knew his name.
That's right.
It was only in sort of the latter part of his career that he became a star in his own right. But tell us some of the top 40 type recordings you can hear him on.
Well, you could hear him on any of the Dion and the Belmont records. He was on Runaround Sue and Teenager in Love. Those were big ones. He was on, there's a Nat Cole record that he was on, and Freddie Cole said it was his first date, but it was Late in the Game, and I'll think of the title of it, but there was only one track, and he told me about that. But he's the rhythm guitar player on Georgia On My Mind. Hey. He was on Del Shannon's Runaway. I think there's some Leslie Gore records that he was a part of. There may have been.
Why not?
Four Seasons records. He did Dion, when Dion left the Belmonts and did Ruby Baby, he was on that record. When we did Bucky's 85th birthday party at the 92nd Street Y, we did a whole medley of those songs. So I think Stand By Me was another one that he was on.
Wow.
And Dion wrote a beautiful note about how they came up with a little thing on Teenager in Love, and he was always grateful about that. And there were just so many interesting. And, you know, in those days, my father said, if you could hold a guitar, you got it on a record date, you know, because there was always five guitars on a record. And the guitar was the instrument. And they even they came out of these acoustic guitars that they put pickups on. So they needed amplifiers in the studio. It was before direct boxes, where you'd go directly to the tape from the guitar. They had a mic the amp, so they had an amplifier club. So all the guys, I've seen lists, all the guys would put in the money. My father was the treasurer. That was a little sketchy. And they'd have an amplifier in all the studios. And then they had lockers, and they had, and everybody who was in the club had a key to the amplifier.
Oh, man.
Huh. It was an amazing time. He's on Janiceans at 17. And so there's a whole slew of records that he made. Wow. That there's definitely Tony Bennett records. There are there's a couple of, he's on Cycles, Sinatra's record. It's called Cycles.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with Sinatra a number of times. So pretty much worked with everybody, he said, except Bing Crosby.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And when you were growing up, there were musicians around the house all the time. And
So we had Benny Goodman.
Yeah. Wow. Benny Goodman. No big deal. Just Benny Goodman. Les Paul.
Yeah, just Benny Goodman. Les Paul. And then there was Zoot Sims and Slam Stewart. Those were like the core group. We had there was a day when Joe Venuti was a great violin player, worked a lot with Bing Crosby, came over. And that was a funny day because I remember I must have been 17. So it was 1977. And he came over, and somewhere in the midst of Joe Venuti eating there, there was a bunch of people all there. And the phone rang, and my father picked it up, and it was Les Paul. And Les Paul said to my father, I hear Joe Venuti's in town. Do you know where he is? And my father said, he's on my couch. He says, I'll be right there. So he drove from, you know, the 10 minutes from Mahwah to come to our house. And we had Les Paul and Joe Venuti telling stories about being on the road together. And sort of like, you know, there were all those kinds of moments. So it was really, it was amazing. And, you know, we got to view Benny Goodman from afar. When Benny Goodman showed up, you had a, go upstairs, you know, sort of like stay upstairs. So you came down the stairs and you could peek and say, oh, there he is. He's over there. And sometimes when Benny would have to go to New York to do something with his clarinet or whatever it was, he'd say, I'm headed back to Connecticut, Bucky. Can I stop at your place for lunch? So my mother would make lunch. Maybe he'd go for a swim and then he'd take a nap on our parents' bed. So you'd see, you'd come up from school and there was Benny, and it was an old school thing. He was sleeping in his shirt and tie with boxer shorts and his socks on because he didn't want to ruin the crease on his pants.
You know?
But there was the king of swing is sleeping. Don't make any noise. You know?
Well, I saw your dad and Joe Venuti at Carnegie Hall recreating the Joe Venuti, Eddie Lang duets from the early 30s. And that was thrilling. That was just thrilling.
It's they made a record together. It's called Joe Venuti and His Blue Four, and Bucky did a number of things on it. And the duets are astonishing. And I have a cassette of Joe playing a number of tunes with my dad that day. And then Joe even played something on the piano that I recorded, and he told a couple of great stories that I have on the cassette. And and then Les showed up and Les played, but I didn't get any of that. But it was amazing. So those duets with Joe Venuti are special. Now, my question is, before we go any further, do you know a movie called Carnegie Hall?
Yes. Yes,
so
I do.
Evidently, Vaughn Monroe is in that movie.
Yep.
And you can spot my father somewhere. So that's I tied Bucky Pizzarelli into the a screen portion of the interview.
Obviously.
That now ups the ante on a mediocre movie considerably. No offense to fans of Vaughn Monroe or Marsha Hunt, who was in it, and a lot of other people. Great classical musicians are in the film.
Racing with the Moon.
Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I'm trying. You're breaking it a little bit, but yeah, it was.
Now, you know, it's kind of mind blowing. I say this all the time to people. The fact that we have a handful of folks who are still that one away connection, it's precious, because once it's gone, it really is gone. And so whether it's the few friends we have who are still alive, who worked with Hitchcock or knew, Charlie Chaplin, et cetera, all those kinds of things, to have someone say, oh no, I was in that room, I spoke to them directly. When you're talking about these kinds of icons and legends and sort of larger than life, like Benny Goodman, a larger than life character, it's just kind of mind blowing, isn't it? And the idea that they were there and real.
Yes. And my mother's story was growing up as a Bobby Soxer in the 40s when Sinatra came to town. She went to the Paramount to hear Sinatra. And when my father played the White House with Harry Como and Sinatra to sing for the president of Italy. So they got two rhythm sections. They got Tony Mottola and Bucky Pizzarelli, Nick Perito and Vinnie Falcone, Gene Chirico on bass and Irv Cutler on drums. And they made this presentation for the president of Italy. But the night before, Sinatra took everybody out. She said, Perry Como went to sleep. And we all went to dinner, and my mother got to sit across from Frank Sinatra.
Jeez.
And she was sitting there, and she still and the story that way that she would tell how Sinatra said, well, I guess when the night was over, she listened to him tell stories about Tommy Dorsey and everything. And then at the end, she stood up and said, well, good night. And he leaned forward, and she was leaning forward, and she in her mind was going, Ruth Litchfield from Waldwick, New Jersey, is going to kiss Frank Sinatra. And she kissed him right on the lips and never forgot it. And that's another piece of that.
Yeah.
You know, how my mother got to have that moment with her star, you know.
Absolutely.
I got to shake Paul McCartney's hand and work with him, and James Taylor also, people from my generation, which I never thought would happen. McCartney especially too, because he's just amazing, you know.
Something that I think folks like you learned and understood is that it's supposed to look easy. It's supposed to look like you're having a good time. And when you watch someone like Paul McCartney perform, he somehow makes it look like he hasn't played those same songs 7 billion times. And he understands how much that music means to everybody. And that when he plays, it is joy. And you know, for anybody, you watch him and you just go, I can't believe it. There he is. He's amazing. And I think that that's something that certain generations did not seem to get a handle of, is that it's supposed to look like fun, you know?
And the people you're playing for have put you where you are. And so when I've worked with Bucky, it was actually my little gigs at bars in New Jersey in my 20s were the ones where I realized, you know, you really can't drink a beer before your gig, because there's like at the end of the night when you thought, you know, there'll be somebody who'll come up and you'll say, like, you were here, you know? What was I thinking? Every gig matters. Yeah. And even like Paul McCartney knows that the Fenway Park gig matters, because somebody's there for the first time. And I, you know, when I worked with James and when I worked with James Taylor and with McCartney, they both in the studio had, you know, you could say, oh, I know why they're so popular.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're great people. But secondly, they're really great musicians. And that was so exciting to see Paul working so hard on this project of standards. And the same thing with James, you know. So you go, oh, yeah, they know this is forever. And really, it's not like, yeah, we'll just do that. It was never that.
One of the turning, I don't know if it's turning point, but one of the legendary moments in jazz history was when Miles Davis turned his back on the audience. Was it at a Newport Festival? I think so. And somebody put lyrics to his was it his tune, So What? Somebody put lyrics to it and sort of made fun of the whole situation. That
right.
Miles could get away with it because he was Miles.
He broke the mold, you know, but that was what made, you know, that made his thing special too, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, even like what was so fun about Benny Goodman was when they did these gigs and they would record the last night after 6 weeks. My father would go to Europe with Zoot Sims and Benny Goodman and these groups, and they would make music at the, you know, they, and you can, there's a video of one of them from Copenhagen. You just go, these guys are having the time of their lives, you know. They're just so, you could see the idea. And like when they're going, you know, and Benny's just sort of looking there going, well, this isn't bad. You know, just get to play Stomping at the Savoy in different parts of the world. It's working out pretty good for me, you
know? So what was it like when you started to play music? Was it scary? Was it intimidating? Or was it just sort of, this is what everyone does in this house?
When I started to do it for a living is when it got a modicum that was scary to it, you know, where I would, and I didn't get too nervous on the little club dates. Most of the time, you know, go into Nobody's Inn in Mahwah and play my 3 hour, 4 hours, do my little gigs.
Yeah.
But like there were times every once in a while when I realized, oh, I got to do, I think it was maybe when I left Bucky, quote unquote, when I had my first trio in 1990, 91. And then we're like walking into a room and I'm going, oh, I'm driving this bus now.
Right.
With Bucky, it was the two of us. And we had done 10 years of stuff and we knew we could go in anywhere, any room, any building and go, we own this room. Let's do this thing. We can do this. That was that thing, you know, we were always so cocky, you know. So then I was like, oh, I have to get that level now with my own group. And that quickly had to figure that part out. And that took a little bit of doing so that I didn't get all fatuts. I think I even remember, so it worked out very well. But the last time I really got nervous about anything, I did a Sinatra show at Lincoln Center at the Appel Room. And I remember thinking, I know what the show is, but like my hands are sweating. My hands haven't sweat in years. And here, you know, I'm getting like, I guess I know I got to try and deliver this thing. So that, you know, it was at the beginning, it was sort of, you know, I had to realize I got to put together something that's as good as what I was doing with Bucky. I think that's what I always go back to, how well we played together, what we were doing.
Yeah. When did you start singing?
I always sang. I sang since I was six. The Beatles records, you know, I sang to all the Beatles records and pretend I was playing the guitar or whatever, the bass. And I sang in rock bands for dances and things like that. And then my buddy was a singer and needed an accompanist. The guy I went to high school with sang all the Dick Haymes and he looked like Dick Haymes. He sang all the Bing Crosby and Sinatra tunes. So I learned a lot of repertoire from him. He would say, do you know this one? I was like, no, I can't begin to tell you how much you mean to me. Okay, I know that. And then the other one was from one of those, let's see, every time you're near a rose, aren't you glad you got a nose? Aren't you glad you're you? Yeah. All those, you know, those songs. And so we'd work in an Italian restaurant and he'd say, you sing something. And I was like, I don't know anything. And I would sing, you know, a James Taylor tune or something. And I had no repertoire. And it was Joe's sister, Nancy, gave me a record of a guy named Frank Weber. And on it was Straighten Up and Fly Right. And she said, you should do that song. And I played it played it for Bucky. And he rolled his eyes. He said, it's not a Frank Weber song. It's a Nat King Cole song. Mm. Go to the Sam Goody, New Jersey and in Paramus and find the records.
Garden State Plaza.
Go to Paramus.
Of course. The intersections of 4 and 17. And
I know
they
well.
Had, the yes, the brand new, it was brand new, Best of the King Cole Trio, volumes 1 and 2. I was like, how easy was this? And went back to Bucky's turntable and said, here they are. He goes, okay, put them on. Paper Moon. And he was like, boy, bump, play that. There goes, he got Body and Soul. I said, yeah, he goes, play that one. And I remember the way he had his hands and the way he looked out the window while that music was playing. And I was like, oh, we're all having a moment here. I'm getting the beginning and he's going back 40 years to go, oh yeah, this is the music. Yeah. This is why I wanted to do this. It was so beautiful. I can still see him the way he looked out that window thinking, gee, these guys are so good. And I was thinking, boy, these guys are great. And yes, this is what I got to do now. I got to learn all these songs. And that's what became my repertoire. Yes. So the good news was, as I didn't have to sing anything over my head. Everything was Route 66, Frim Fram Sauce, Straighten Up and Fly Right. I was like, oh, these are good songs for me. I'm 21. I can't be singing Lush Life yet.
Right.
Until I'm, you know, 70, you know. So it laid it, it was a great foundation of material for me. And then, as you guys would know, as I went on, I was on WNEW a lot in those days, which was 1130 AM radio in New York. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy named Rich Connedy. You remember Rich Connedy?
Yes.
It was a great guy. And Rich would say, oh, you know what? I ran some of my 78s off for you. And he had older 78s and Nat Cole material. Here, you should learn This Will Make You Laugh. That's a great song. Mm. Somebody else along the way, Beautiful Moons Ago would be a great, you know. So I started to have this sort of hip little repertoire before it was hip, you know. And my father was introducing me to Joe Mooney Records. So I was starting to develop a pretty hip little repertoire for someone, you know. In 1983, I was the guy, but I mean, it was sort of like I was discovering things because I had, you know, the father who knew how to say, here's, go there. This is going to work for you.
Well, as they say, everything old is new again.
Yeah.
Yes.
There is something so funny about the different songs that you learn, right? And you said, so you made the Lush Life joke, which is one that comes up frequently, I think, because if you try to sing it when you're 15, people go, no. I had a singing teacher say, you can't sing Send in the Clowns till you're at least 50.
Well, but you know, there's somebody who was 15. There was a singer who sang Second Time Around on her first record.
Yeah.
And was going, well, the first time around had to be
first time hasn't
like
happened
second
yet.
Grade. It was second grade.
So we talk about this because I started the voice teacher when I was 12. And the first song she had me learn was Cry Me a River. And I still laugh looking back at it now and thinking, I was really trying. I was giving it my all. In what world did I know about heartbreak and love other than like Care Bears? And it is so funny.
How about, and just the word plebeian.
Plebeian, right.
Well, I took Latin. So that one was all right for me. I got that one. But no, it is so funny. You think about some of the stuff you get handed and you go, what in the world? How could I possibly do that?
Now you do something.
Hang on, wait, I was saying.
No, go ahead.
You do something that very few people can. And that is that you can sing while playing an improvisatory chorus.
Yeah.
You can be improvising with your fingers and your voice.
Mouth.
like Slam Stewart, the great Slam Stewart, and also Major Holly, the two great bass players who did that. And do you understand how that works?
Yeah, you know what, for me it was, and you know, you mentioned Slam Stewart, because we talked about him being at the house too. He was a good friend of my father's. What happened was, is basically in 1975, 76, I got that George Benson record of This Masquerade, and I sort of learned what was going on in there. I was like, oh, okay. So I sort of memorized what I was playing, and I could sing along to it. And I started to apply it to certain things. And on my second record, I was doing it a little bit, you know, starting to get a hang of it. So figuring, oh, that was sort of cool. And I knew Slam did it because he did it, you know, in our living room. I was like, okay. So I remember on the second record, I said, the intro should go. And I went, boo, boo, doo, 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 doo. And I played it for Bucky. And he said, well, you do it. Do it like that. And so now I'm thinking, well, I'm doing this on a record now. And and it became a way for me, that particular thing, because I was starting to get better. But I wanted to be able to, if I sang and played, it slowed my hands down and I could play a little more melodically doing it. So this was something that just happened over a period of time, and I got good at it. But the guitar leads the voice. People always want to know which came first, the chicken or the egg. It's right. The guitar leads the voice.
Okay. Okay. Well, that is
Bucky Pizzarelli and John Pizzarelli on The Guitar Leads the Voice. Later tonight.
We were lucky enough, my wife and I, to see you all at the short-lived Hollywood Cinegrill. When Michael Feinstein was running that room, and you all being you and your talented wife, Jessica Molaski, and your talented dad, Bucky Pizzarelli, and your group, which then included your brother, Martin, on screen bass. And I don't remember if it was Ray Kennedy or Larry Fuller at that time on piano.
It was Ray.
Mm-hmm.
Did you just get a good group rate? Was that the...
Yeah, it was good because most of the times you could get Martin to stay with Bucky, you saved on a room.
There you go. It's why you married a singer, because then you had her, whenever you needed her.
She stays with me. She stays with me. He stays with Bucky. We're down the two room.
Nailed it. No, you have been a Jessica Molaski fan.
Oh yeah, no,
forever.
And you two are still doing Radio Deluxe.
Yes, we are. We've been doing that now for 18 years, I think. Wow. And our 14 listeners are thrilled still that we're out there.
This is, if you're not familiar with it, folks, John and Jessica have turned time backwards. In an era of modern communication, they have gone the old-fashioned route, tried and true, and they are doing what we now call terrestrial radio, but it's a radio show, and it's a wonderful radio show where they talk talk about their lives, talk about their colleagues and their careers and the songs that they love, and spin discs, as they used to say. And it's a wonderful show.
Oh, thank you. Well, it just came out of, I guess, somebody, from us working together, and we would say hello and people would laugh. And so somebody suggested we make a radio show out of it. And so we just sit at the same place we're sitting at now for most of the time, or in the city. And we go to separate corners and make out lists of songs, and it turns into something. But I think the key for us is there's no playlist. So some weeks it could be, and I've tried to, I think I get crazy eclectic, and Jessica's great at finding newer people and some great Broadway stuff. I like to go back to every once in a while, find like a cast recording of something unusual and play that. Or I like to play Bob and Ray, because I love Bob and Ray, so I'll try to find a funny sketch of them.
Never a bad time for Bob and Ray.
He loves Bob
and Ray. And whatever breaks me up. And then, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, it's supposed to be fun. That's, that's the best part of sharing what you love.
And we don't have a playlist. That's the best part. So, I think what's really terrific is no one's ever told us not to play anything. So we just say, sure, this is what we... And that's what's worked out really great. And I think that was the kind of radio that we got out of New York too, in the 70s and 80s, where the people that I liked just played whatever they wanted to, and you'd go, wow, that was fantastic. And could make a flowing line out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And if people want to find Radio Deluxe, which is the name of your show, they can go where online?
JohnPizzarelli.com will have post set lists, and you can hear the shows there or anytime at MixCloud.com. Just write in Radio Deluxe, and you'll can hear all the shows are there. And that's then great. if you're in a city where you want to hear it, you can go to JohnPizzarelli.com, and you can see where we're on around the country.
That's great.
Fantastic.
And all the soy farmers here in Southern California who arise early on Sundays, I'm sure are tuning you in.
That's right.
I'm KJ. Early out there. It's six in the morning.
Oh. I'm looking at the CD here at Stage and Screen. P.S. Buy CDs. It's nice to hold them and read them. And it's really nice to read. I mean, that's something I really looked forward to when I would buy, you go to Tower Records here, go to Tower Records, and you'd buy CDs, and people had put so much time and effort into everything. And oftentimes there were not just liner notes, but, there'd be pictures and booklets. Yeah, all kinds of stuff. And I really miss that because I think that it was precious. And
well, now it's even just for the people, just for personnel.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Absolutely.
But I would say I've made more friends with people who I admired that, like in particular, say a guy like Russ Teitelman, who's a great record producer of a lot of records in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and 90s. He did my Bossa Nova record because we became friends. So the first time I met him, I went, you did this and this. And what about this and this? And he was going, I said, I'm a liner note reader. Yeah. So I was always interested in like, oh, you did this one on this record, and he was just like, oh, okay. I was a serious chap about reading, not just, I want to know what the producer was. And then I'd read the thank yous and I'd say, well, who's you thank this one thing? Who was Jerry? He goes, oh, Jerry was my Saint Bernard.
Right. That's how we are with credits, with film credits. It's the exact same thing.
You sit in the theater till the end. You sit all the way till the lights go up.
What do you always say?
It's not over until you've been threatened with criminal and civil prosecution. That's when the movie's over.
We should make a shirt that says that for you.
Yeah.
No, it's the truth. And it's the same thing. Well, a game we play is the most fun names. We like to find the most ridiculous names.
Oh, yeah. The job titles.
Job titles are great.
Foam latex supervisor.
That's a solid one. But just different nicknames are great. Pixar often does all the babies that were born, but also sometimes like in Tangled, they did all of the all the animals that were born during filming. So it's just little funny things. But again, it's because it's in there, it makes you go, well, what's that? Same thing. Sometimes an actor will be attached to a project just to help it get off the ground and then they leave. And so in the credits, it'll say, thank you, Leonardo DiCaprio. And you ask the director, why does it say that? And he goes, well, he attached himself as the lead so we could go and have interviews with XYZ and they could decide if they wanted the film. When they said yes, Leo left. And, it's like it's little gems that are so interesting.
So your new album is called Stage and Screen.
Yeah.
And it's on Palmetto Records.
Oh, you do one of my favorite songs ever, Some Other Time.
Oh.
That is
I played it as a guitar solo on the record because I learned it during the pandemic.
Sure.
Because I was learning a song a day. Oh, that's okay. You can't hear the banging. Can you hear the banging?
No, you're fine.
Oh, we're okay, Jess. That was Jessica Malasky.
Hi, Jessica Malasky.
Big hellos. So that was one of the pieces that I learned because I love the I love Bill Evans' arrangement for when he played for Tony Bennett. So I've always loved, and I know I had run into Adolph Green a number of times at Christmas, Hal Prince's Christmas party, if I may drop those two names. Mm. And Amanda Green, Adolph's daughter, is good friends of ours. So I wanted to put one of those tunes on the record. But I got also Just in Time from Bells Are Ringing, and the verse appeared in a piece of sheet music that we had. I had never heard the verse before, so The verse is really cool. I was resting comfortably face down in the gutter. Life was serene. I knew where I was at. There's no hope for him, my dearest friends would mutter. I was something dragged in by the cat. Then, just in time, I met you. So, I mean, those kinds of things were fun to explore. And so I got two Adolf and Betty things on there.
Yeah.
Now, now you do the verse to one of my all-time favorite songs from my all-time favorite movie, Casablanca.
Yeah.
And
As Time Goes By is my parents' song.
That was our wedding, it's our forever song.
Yeah.
But very, very few people, except Tony Bennett, I think is the only one I ever heard sing that verse.
Where do you think I learned the verse? On that record. My father's on that record. It's a record called Life is Beautiful. And it was one of the, Tony made the two records with Bill Evans, and then he made Life is Beautiful, which they did in Rochester. And Jack Rollins was one of the executive producers of the label and everything, Improv Records. And then he did those Richard Rodgers records with George Barnes and Ruby Braff. Mm-hmm. That was like that period of time when he was like going, nobody wants me to sing standards anymore, so I'm just going to go on my own and sing standards. And I had that record, and he sings the verse. So my first gig at the Oak Room with my own trio, I did a little verse medley up front. And the last song of the medley was the verse to As Time Goes By, Into As Time Goes By. And Tony Bennett was there like in the third week, was sitting right in front of me.
Oh, man.
And I remember going, this day and age we are living in gives cause for apprehension. And I looked right at him and he was like, keep going. You know, I was like, learning from you.
I'm sure you've got. So Linda Ronstadt has, according to several music aficionados that we know well, ruined certain songs, specifically, and it's no disrespect to her, but specifically Someone to Watch Over Me. Because when she sings, I know he may not be the man some girls think of as handsome. And it was Miles. There's a whole heap of friends who went, you're losing the couplet. You can't sing it like Ronstadt. You lose the couplet. It rhymes. I know you may not be the man some girls think of as handsome. And it's those funny, funny little things. And now it makes me laugh whenever I hear it. Because you know who you learned it from.
Well, exactly. And because of stuff like that, and from knowing these people, and we, you know, Jessica being a Sondheim nut.
Sure.
And knowing, and that's, there's a Rubik's Cube.
Oh, God,
itself.
Yeah.
I remember I sang, It's the Last Dance. That's the last dance. We're having da, 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 da. They're aware of us, the pair of us on the floor. Da, 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 da. And there's, just when will we leave? But till we leave, keep holding me tight. It's a Sammy Kahn lyric. And Tita Kahn called me up and said, I got the record and it's really great. I did a number of Sammy things on there. But she said, just when will we leave? But till we leave, she goes, you made an old songwriter happy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, my job is done. You know, I know people are listening. You know,
that's right. Well, mommy's favorite line from some other time is, haven't had time to wake up seeing you there without your makeup. That's her favorite from that song. Town anyway. I deeply love On the Town.
It's a great song.
But that song is just...
Now I will lay bare, I will confess, you include on this recording two songs I'd never heard.
Ooh.
One of them is by...
I can tell you which ones they are.
Yes, go on.
So it's probably I Love Betsy.
Yep.
And Coffee in a Cardboard Cup.
You got it. Tell us about both of those.
Well, Coffee in a Cardboard Cup. I saw, this is because you have good friends, you know. A buddy of mine took me to see, his name is Joseph Cosgriff, and he took me to see a review of Candor and Ebb's songs in a small theater in New York. And I remember hearing this song about coffee. I was thinking, that's a good song. That stayed with me, that song in particular. I was like, that was fun. And I remember, so I'm taking the long route. When I saw the production of Big, the first song of the second act is a song about coffee. And I was like, that's a good song. It's a coffee song. And that was Maltby and Shire. So I recorded Coffee Black, which began the second act of Big. And I still had this other song in my brain. And Jessica said, we got to do a thing for Candor and Ebb. And Jessica had recorded all that jazz. So she said, it was for John Candor, right? Yeah. And so we're at the Hudson Theater. So she was going to do all that jazz. And what would you? And I said, there's a coffee song. There's a coffee song. went through the book, and there's coffee in a cardboard cup. And I was like, that's it. And it turned out there were three verses. There's two verses somewhere, and somebody, one of the sheet music things that I found had three verses, and it was from a show called 70 Girls 70. I didn't know anything about the show. All I knew was I liked the song. And it was perfect. You know, that's the thing, is the hard part about making a record like this or any record is up-tempo songs. And yep. It's trying to find
always
something that gives the connection between time after time and as time goes by and where or when. You need something that's going to go bump, bump, da, 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 yep. Da, da. It's an old-fashioned, there's that number. So that's where that song came from, is because we had to do something for John Candor, and it was always in my brain. And the other one, I Love Betsy, I saw Honeymoon in Vegas on Broadway. Jason Robert Brown wrote the score. Andy Bergman wrote the book. And that's the opening number. And I always thought of it like my show, when I put together a little program, I always like the fourth or fifth number to be sort of like a little piece of sherbet or a nice little vignette. So like if I do like a little jump number, then I do the second number is always something that's sort of mid-tempo, like when I take my sugar to tea, and then I got rhythm, and then a ballad, and then that next number is something unusual. And in my act for many years, it's been Rhode Island is Famous for You.
Mm-hmm.
So I, because it's this great little thing, pencils come from Pennsylvania, vests from West Virginia, all these little lists. It's like a Let's Do It kind of song.
Sure.
And so I heard everything this guy likes. I like taxis, I like trains, but I love Betsy. And I was like, well, that's great. And at the end, just like Jay-Z and Beyonce, I will make her my fiance. It's just a smart song. And so I said, that's my new list song. And Jason was very nice to let me. I edited out a piece of part of it that was, part of what the show was about, sure, which I didn't need. He's like, yeah, you can take that out. It was like, great.
He is so Jason Robert Brown. I don't know how he does what he does and how he comes up with things the way he comes up with things, but man, and I love that Parade is back on Broadway, because the music for that is so beautiful.
The woman you just saw back here was in the original production of that show.
Really?
And I remember going to see that, and actually Hal Prince's idea for that show was, Jessica was the mother of the girl's name.
Pause for 1 second, because you're breaking up and I don't want to lose what you're saying.
Let me see, it'll click.
There you go.
It'll take a second to get That's us okay. all back.
That's okay.
Better?
Keep talking.
There you go.
There you
okay,
go.
Okay, so what I'm saying is,
so Jessica.
Yeah, Jason's a special guy. Jessica was in his first show, which as she said, trunk songs of an unknown 23-year-old songwriter.
Yep.
And so she did her song, and that was called Stars in the Moon, which has been one of his sort of early hits.
Yes.
And then his first Broadway show was Parade in 1998.
And I listened to that album. It's beautiful. Now he's so talented, and I love that you've chosen to do a song of his. That's perfect.
Now, do you know you have another trunk song in this collection?
Let me think. Well, the thing that was interesting about T for Two and I Want to Be Happy is they were the last songs added to the show. They were out of town ads, I've read, but I don't know. What would that be?
Well, you do You're All the World to Me, Fred Astaire introduced on screen in Royal Wedding. But that was a Burton Lane trunk song, because if you see the 1934 Eddie Cantor movie, Kid Millions, which you're not going to see because it's full of blackface stuff. So the exact same melody is accompanied by the lyrics, I want to be a minstrel man. And so there's no danger of that being revived.
Right. There was a, what was the, I was privy to a conversation with Alan Bergman and Bill Charlap. Mm-hmm. Oh, I think it might have been the original lyric to The Gal That Got Away.
Alan knew those lyrics.
Yeah.
I've heard him recite them before. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. I think it was Johnny Mercer's lyrics.
Yeah.
Johnny Mercer had the, yeah.
And one of the great songs on this collection is one of the great American standards, Time After Time. But it is from a fairly obscure movie. It's an MGM musical in black and white, starring Frank Sinatra and Jimmy Durante and many others. And but it's Time After Time. Find a better song. You can't find a better song than that.
You know, the thing about Time After Time is it has been a, what do you call it? It's been such a problem for me for years, because I always had it was Van Cliburn's favorite song. And whenever he came to the Pierre, when Bucky and I were playing there, we had to play Time After Time. And I never spent the time to get the right chords under my hand. So I was always playing it, always screwing it up. And I was like, Time After Time, here he comes again. I got to play Time After Time. And then when I do these Thursday night shows online during the pandemic and still do them. The show's called 5 o'clock somewhere on John Pizzarelli Official, whenever I can do them now. But I would take requests on Monday, get it all together, and then on Thursday, perform everyone's requests. And Time After Time came up all of the time. And I was thinking, this is Van Cliburn's telling me I better learn this damn song.
Mm.
And I finally spent the time to get the right chords and learn the song. And it's become my new favorite song. It really is. It's such a great song. So it was. And another one, there's another Sammy Kahn song, you know, just one of the great songwriters on the planet.
Indeed. I saw Julie Stein years and years ago at the 92nd Street Y. They were still doing their Lyrics and Lyricists series. And he was a very talented pianist. And that's how he started out, demonstrating songs, like at Woolworth's, you know, in the days of sheet music.
Sure.
And he made a hilarious crack about, I'm not just playing over the chords here. I'm playing the real chords.
Yeah, well, he used to always say, they don't go home humming the chords.
Yeah.
I love that.
Indeed.
I want to do a quick turn back, because it's one of my favorite albums of yours. You mentioned Bossa Nova.
Hmm.
And I think the first time I saw you live was
At Catalina
with Daniel Jobim. And you guys were obviously so good, but it was so much fun to hear that music changed just a little bit to be yours and his. And folks, if you don't know offhand who Antonio Carlos Jobim is, you probably heard his music. You just don't know that you have. And was this his son or grandson?
Grandson.
Grandson, Daniel, that you worked with. And man, so beautiful. Again, fun. Just Waters of March is one of the, I love that song. But
well, it's almost the Brazilian Lush Life, but it's accessible, because it tells such a great story. And you know, that all those all that time I spent with him, with Daniel, was so educational about the music. And, you know, it was always, he knew how he wanted those songs played too. There was always like, you know, my grandfather, he plays this chord, but so don't play that other chord, isn't good. And it was really, we had such a great time of making the record. And we made two. We actually made it. We made that Bossa Nova record, and we made one later on called Sinatra and Jobim at 50, which celebrated that collaboration. So those were special. That's part of the fun of getting to be having a modicum of success in this business and being able to find people that you didn't never thought you'd meet. And this that 6 degrees of separation to Jobim, and it's pretty magical.
Yeah.
Well, you had a wonderful collaboration with George Shearing many years ago, where you even replicated the album cover of the album he made with Nat King Cole.
Yeah, that was just that was another one too, that where the record company said, "Hey, we owe George a record and we owe you a record. You want to make a record together?" I was like, "Yeah, that would be sensational." And George lived really close. He was only a couple of blocks in New York City from me, and so we got to go over and rehearse. And on about the fifth time I was there, he said, "You want to have some tea?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." Even Ellie, his wife, said, "This, you know, not anybody gets to sit and have tea with George Shearing. You know, this is a big deal that you got to stay." And we got to talk about records and music and Mel Torme and Peggy Lee. And so those kinds of things are I'm glad you like those records too, because they were really fun to make. And my thing I want to get back to is, you know, in Casablanca, to get back to that, it still amazes me, because it's really one of my favorite movies also, and I haven't watched it in a while. I got to watch it. It's just the way Warner Brothers got all of that music. Each guy has a specific song, and there's like the way The Very Thought of You is used when she walks in, the way you know, there's always a song.
Love for Sale's in there.
Yeah, and you know, the Marseillaise and all that, and Avalon's in there. There's all these great songs that are, you know, oh yeah, look how we got that. I love Knock on Wood, and I love It Had to Be You, and it's just it's the music is, there's so many pieces of that movie that are what's great about all, everything that is great about the movies is in that movie. You know, it's just so, and the star power of that thing, the way you know, Bogart is just spot on perfect, and Ingrid Bergman is spot on beautiful, and everybody else is, you know, vying for this, and you know, Bogart's just got the attention of everybody, you know.
Yeah,
everybody who opens their mouth and utters a line in that movie is perfect. They're all colorful and interesting.
Yeah, I always say that. Actually, you know, we stayed, and when you stay in São Paulo, you stay at an airport right near the airport. There's a bunch of airports, but there's like a LaGuardia kind of airport right near where we would always stay. And my brother and I would be down at breakfast or something, and we would look, and a plane would fly out, and I'd say there goes the last plane to Lisbon. He would always like, "What?" I said, "Don't worry about it." So I just always would say that when the plane would fly overhead. It was crazy.
This pillow lives on this couch. I was misinformed.
It's fantastic. every line is the line you want to always remember. You know, it's just, "Can I get you a cab? Time of day, time of night," or whatever. It's just every little thing is just so beautiful. You just go, you know.
Yeah.
Forever holding your breath on that.
You appreciate great things because you are inspired to do great things. Musically, and you're also a great entertainer. You and Jessica both, and there are some very talented jazz musicians who are not necessarily playing to the audience.
Well, it's a skill, isn't it? It's a separate skill.
It is.
It's you know.
Well, it's a skill that, I mean, I built my skill, quote unquote. I mean, I always thought it comes out of all these things, but mostly it was my television viewing. I loved Johnny Carson, and I loved listening to comedy records. And the part of that is that it was the storytelling. It was like watching Sinatra create a joke and bomb, or how to get out of the bomb, and listening to George Carlin tell a story about his childhood and go, okay. And just the way that these things happen, and the three concerts that shaped what I wanted to do as an entertainer were Sinatra at the Brennan Byrne Arena in March 14th of 86. And Billy Joel was 83 on December 26th. And then the other one was Springsteen in the summer of 85. And it wasn't about the show. The shows were great, but I loved the way Billy Joel shaped the show, because he went tune, 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 stop. How's everybody doing? Tune. And then was there was something magical happened after the third tune. The thing about Springsteen was I didn't know half the material. And he was able to sit there in 76,000 people and tell a story that's going to say, here's where we're headed. But it begins with this story about him walking on the boardwalk in Asbury Park, and he's playing, just strumming a few chords and telling this 10-minute story. And he did the same thing when I was in college. I listened to a Springsteen concert on the radio. I had never heard him before. And I was like, that was a Friday night. I'm by myself. Here's the radio. And I'm sitting there and going, okay, I'll give this 15 minutes and I'll go to the Rathskeller. And I sat there for 2 hours because this guy was, I'm going on the radio. Stories. And Sinatra, the way he held court, the way he, and that night, I'll never forget, he had his mic at his side and he walked back to the pit and he said, hot tonight. And he went, what do we got? No BS. And just went out there and went, boom. And then when he does one for my baby at the perfect time of the show. And so I just said, all of these ingredients have to go into how my little trio is going to present a show.
Yeah.
There's going to be something, because it's not about the jazz fan. They know what's coming. It's about the person they brought with them who doesn't know what's coming. And why is he doing this song? Oh, it was written by those guys from a show. Oh, that's sort of interesting. And now he's telling a story about his father. Oh, and then he's going to, I like that song because he tied it into the story of this or that.
Yeah.
And I just feel like that's, you've got to do that, because I don't care what club you're in or where you are, I always say it's not about those, it's about the people who came with them.
Yeah.
Dragged along.
Very smart.
And well, it's part of entertainment. You know, they're spending their hard earned money.
Absolutely.
Say no.
Yeah. My dad just got to see Vince Giordano and the Nighthawks here in LA. They played at CSUN, actually. There's a fantastic auditorium that they built at Cal State Northridge, which is a city college here.
Oh, it's a great place.
Yeah, and my parents just went and saw him. And I love when my dad comes home from a gig, because he's buzzing.
Yeah.
And it is that thing that is so joyful. And obviously now that we've got to, so my dad made a tape for me when I was very little called Jesse Songs. And now you're going to have to make an Apple playlist for my daughter, because you have to brainwash them early.
Yeah.
As I was.
they find out. They know from, they see it. That's the thing. You know, my daughters, you know, they're in on it all. My son's in. He's 32. He's in. You know, they're like, yeah, I like what you did there. That was good.
But that's the thing. I mean, you mentioned Mel Torme a minute ago, who's one of my favorite. He's just so good all of the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was a bunch of those songs that I love. You talk about pop. I wish more people would do Comes Up Here, The Music Goes Round. It's such a good song. And everybody, it's not hard. It's just fun. And I wish it's something more people did, because it's such a great number. And et cetera. It's, I mean, there's so many to mention. Whoop, I just knocked my microphone. There's so many, you know, to look at. And now I'm getting to do what my dad got to do. And going, I know you don't know who this is. We just showed her Buddy Rich and Animal on the Muppet Show. You know, Buddy Rich, not a face for children, but right. Still, still, you know, it's like, it's just so much fun.
Yeah. Well, when we would drive Maddie back to school in Providence a couple years ago now, she always made a playlist for the ride.
Yeah.
And I think the last time we drove her right after Bruce Springsteen singing Thunder Road was Antonio Carlos Jobim singing The Waters of March. And I said, my work is done here.
That's
yes,
right.
Exactly. As we wrap this up, and we could talk for hours, tell us about your collaborators, your current collaborators.
On this record, actually, really special people. Michael Karn on the bass, as he has been now for about 7 years. You got to add the 2 years that we didn't work, so it's right. Sort of strange.
It's very, yeah. It throws everything.
Yeah, he's a special person. He's a great bass player. He's an even greater human being. And Isaiah J. Thompson on piano. I did his first gig with me in December of 2019. And then did like two or three in 2020. And then I didn't see him for another year and a half. So that's basically what spawned the record, is that when we started to work again, we just started picking tunes. And then I said, well, we should record something, get a record out. And I started to look at the things we were doing. And I said, well, those two things from No No Nanette. And I wanted to write this Oklahoma suite. And I've always wanted to get a good record of As Time Goes By. And time after time, movies, stage, and screen. It was the first like non-Nat King Cole record I've made. I've made about 52 Nat King Cole tributes. So I was very happy to find songs outside of that repertoire, you know. So I finally got there in 40 years. I went from Nat Cole, finally got to Too Close for Comfort, you know. It was good.
Well, you've landed well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So congratulations again on a terrific album, and it's called Stage and Screen, and it's on Palmetto Records, or you go online to the various music sources online.
Yes.
And you can download and Frisbee and do whatever else you do now.
I want music delivered by Pigeon.
Right. That'll happen. That's going to come around eventually. But johnpizzarelli.com, and it'll tell you where we're going on tour. We'll be out your neck of the woods in August. So hopefully we'll see you in California.
Great.
Oh, I would love for Daisy to hear you guys live. Because you know what you Bring want is you definitely want an infant at your show. But no, she loves live music. She loves it so much.
We're for everybody.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing to watch them, but to see her reaction to music, is just the best thing.
Yeah.
And oh my God, that would be, as I say, everybody would hate us, but still.
When Jess came about 7 or 8 months pregnant with Maddie to see us play, when Ray Kennedy started to play Sweet Georgia Brown, Maddie was all tumbly turny, you know, it started then.
I mean, if you're going to indoctrinate someone, give them the good stuff.
Right.
You know? No harm.
Thanks again for your time today, John.
Yeah.
Thank you. So great to see you both.
Same here. Back at you. And continued success.
Thank you so much. We'll see you out there soon. And God bless you.
Oh, man. Well. All you can really say.
I'm sorry. I'm only sorry we don't have video as an adjunct to this podcast so that you could see the beaming smile
on
his face. He loves what he does. And it shows.
Yeah.
It shows musically, and it shows in the way he communicates with an audience.
Mm-hmm.
He is, as I said at the very beginning, a great entertainer and a brilliant musician.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever have a chance to see him or him and his wife in person, grab it.
Yeah. There's just no substitute for this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing, to me, it's, again, joy is the only word I can really think of,
yeah.
but watching people do what they do so well and have fun and make it look like it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're up on stage, they make it look like this is where they want to be.
Yeah.
And what a gift to share with people your passion. And it's true, as I say, when you saw Vince the other day, you were just so happy when
yep.
you came home because you saw a great gig by someone you adore and admire.
Yep.
It just doesn't get better. It just doesn't. Man. So yeah, you can check out his website and find more information about him. Can't recommend.
John Pizzarelli.
It's spelled pizza and then R-E-L-L-I. Pizzarelli.
And to find us,
I was going
to
say, what's going to be your super slick slide into
that
it?
Was it.
That was it. I am at Jesse Malton. You are at Leonard Malton on Twitter and Instagram. You are also on Facebook. We do live streams. You can also see on our YouTube channel, which is Malton on Movies. You can go to leonardmalton.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
And then there's Patreon.
Maltreon.
Patreon.com/Malton on Movies, where if you like what we do and want to help us continue doing it, you can make a contribution, small or large. It all matters to us. Believe me, we have different ways of thanking. You can find all that at patreon.com/Malton on Movies. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Today's episode of Malton on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.